The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting for seven continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, listeners. Welcome to the Sunday Space Show program. I'm your host, David Livingston. Thank you very much for tuning in. I think we're going to have a program that interests all of you. It's about human spaceflight and the medical side of human spaceflight. More about that in just a couple of minutes. Our toll-free number, if you would like to call and talk to our guest today, Linda Plush, it is toll-free 1-866-687-7223. Remember, that is the preferred way of communicating with us, so let me put it out there one more time, 1-866-687-7223. You can reach us via email at drspace@thespaceshow.com, and you can also reach us by posting on our blog, which is the spaceshow.com website, all the way to the far right for upcoming shows. This is the first show listed. Open that page up, which is our blog page as well as archive page. Scroll all the way down to the bottom for comments. And as soon as you write your question or comment and post it, I'll get a copy of it. And once again, you do not have to be a member of Discuss and logged in order to use our blog or to comment on it. You can do so as a visitor. But one more time, the preferred way is toll-free 1-866-687-7223. The phone line is available right now if you would like to call. Our newsletter, the website newsletter, will be uploaded after today's show, and it'll be fresh for the entire week. And it will also have the new listings as we're booking into second quarter right now of 2019. Your guest suggestions are welcome. And we do look forward to receiving those from you. Everything we do is archived, and you will be able to download right off of our site, or you can listen off of the site, however you wish to go on that. The file sizes are not very big, so but the shows are either 60 minutes or 90 minutes, give or take. And whatever fits your pleasure is how you can listen to them. There is also Space Show Store, in case you are interested in Space Show logo wear and things with the Space Show name on it. That is in the upper left menu under support, and you'll see TSS, the Space Show gear, on Cafe Press. And that will take you to our Cafe Press homepage, and then you click on whatever kind of item you're interested in. I will tell you there's some new items up there. And to find them, when you get to that homepage on Cafe Press, scroll all the way down to the bottom and you'll see them. There is some Pepper swag there that you may find interesting. So check that out, and your comments, of course, are always welcome. Also in that upper left menu, there is a Listen Live button. This tells you how to listen to live shows. They're all on the Internet, of course. How to listen to compressed MP3s on our website, and then how to do the podcast, including Alexa by Amazon, and the tune-in player is embedded on our website. That will work with Alexa, so if you're using Alexa, there's an easy way for you to use it with Space Show programmings. It's also a really good podcasting app, as I have found out, so I just throw that in to the mix. Remember, we're copyrighted and trademarked, and you do have permission to download and share our programming, although it is easier just to share the URL where the program rests. There are a couple of rules about that. Don't do anything commercial with the programs. Please don't edit, cut, clip. Paste comments up on YouTube or any other website, and written transcripts are not permitted, even if they're for your own use. We podcast through gigadial.net with Andrew. And we're in iTunes and a host of other places. If you have any questions about the podcast or having any problems with it, call it to my attention at drspace@thespaceshow.com. To me, the most important part of the website homepage is that we are a listener-funded and supported space show program. That means that without your financial support and your contributions, there won't be a space show program. So keep in mind, we are a 501c3 nonprofit, and our parent is onegiantleapfoundation.org. And if you pay federal U.S. taxes, you get a tax deduction for your gift. And if you're paying California taxes, you get a California deduction, as we're a California public benefit corporation. Again, check us out at our parent, onegiantleapfoundation.org. And if you're interested in being a Space Show Advisory Board member, email me and let me know, and I'll tell you about it. And if you're interested, we'd like to have you join us. You'll see all of the details under Team on One Giant Leap's website over on the left side. And then when the menu, the drop-down menu opens up, go to Advisory Board. And if you're interested, again, we'd like to have you participate. So please do that. In addition to these individual supporters for the space show, sponsors support us as well. So very quickly, we do have sponsorship banner ads running across our homepage. They rotate. And you can change your sponsorship banner ad as often as you like. And you can certainly change the content that that banner ad is linked to as often as you like. And on a regular length show, such as today's program, I read a short sponsor message, either during the show or at the first of the first segment and the second part of the, at the second segment. But for example, Moonwords is a first segment sponsor. And, their message is, what if a group of nations was determined to build a town on the moon and they based their decision only on technical and economic merit? Moonwords is building a digital vision of that town where you will be able to learn, play, build, and go to events. Visit moonwords.com to download an early draft demo of the town and to fund its development by subscribing. Help us to help the world see a bigger future where we can leave our past behind us. Also, the Space Foundation sponsors us. They have their 35th symposium coming up. The Broadmoor Hotel, Colorado Springs, Colorado, April 8th through the 11th. Their one-stop shopping website for everything, hotel, reservations, conference, you name it, is spacesymposium.org. If you've never been to a space symposium, it is not like anything you've ever been to. It's not like an advocate conference or even an AIAA conference. People from all around the world are there. Top political and global leaders are there in uniform sometimes, which is pretty amazing because they all wear a lot of gold and braid and, you know, stuff like that. Incredible key business people, American Space Corporation people are there. It is really a superb place for networking. Again, like nothing you've ever seen at any other conference, plus their content. So check it out, spacesymposium.org. And then in addition, Northrop Grumman sponsors us, and they are, of course, a very big leading security company providing innovative systems, products, and solutions for government and commercial customers globally. Their portfolio and capabilities include undersea to outer space and cyberspace. It's pretty cool, right? And they're a great company, and we thank them very much for their sponsorship. AIAA sponsors us for the first segment, and they're the world's largest aerospace professional society. They have about 30,000 or so individual members. 88 countries are represented, 95 corporate members. And since all of their people work in aerospace most of the time, they help shape the future of aerospace on a daily basis. So join with them. Go to their events. They have 5 events a year or conferences. You can get a lot more information at AIAA.org. They have an incredible library of reviewed papers on just about every topic you could possibly think of. I used them extensively more than 20 years ago for my doctoral dissertation, and that that library has only grown with expertise and quality. You can join. You don't need to be an engineer to join. And again, it is AIAA.org, another organization with extremely high quality and superb networking. So that brings me to our program today. And Linda Plush is back with us. The last time she was with us was 2005. So that's about 14 years ago. She is the founding president and current executive director of the Space Nursing Society. She's a VP of Space Medicine Associates. She's been on several panels and task forces related to interest in healthcare in space and extreme environments. She is a life member of the Aerospace Medical Association. And over the years, she has worked on the use of medications in the space environment, healthcare issues for suborbital, ISS, and long-duration spaceflight. I can go on and read about her. Her bio is up on the website. It's impressive, and I urge all of you to check it out. And you can listen to her previous program from 2005 and then listen to this one. That's always a great way to keep things in context. Linda, welcome back to the Space Show. How are you?
I am fine. Thanks for having me.
So, 14 years ago, you were on the program, and we still don't have a lot of humans in space, and the U.S. can't even get humans to space yet, although that may be coming up soon. Has the field of human spaceflight medicine really advanced through our ISS work and, say, the twin study and what other countries may have been doing? I guess Russia would be the only other one, maybe China, but we don't hear a lot about China. Have we progressed? Where are we 15 years later?
Well, we have some new data, but it's unfortunately not as much as I would like. I recently attended a meeting of some of the flight surgeons and quite a few of the NASA engineers, as well as some engineers that are from civilian. And they were looking at the implications of the last 58 years of human spaceflight. So we took a look at that. And, we've got some work to do. There's a lot left that hasn't been done.
Are we learning a lot of new things? Are we mitigating things that we've always known existed, like radiation and microgravity, for example, or only realizing that they're harder to possibly mitigate than before? Where does our progress come from?
Well, okay, before I jump in with both feet and hands, I'd like to tell everybody that I'm an advocate of going. I want us to go, but I'm also a realist. And so magical thinking is a enemy. You have to look it in the face and really know what you're dealing with so that you can prepare properly. I don't want to have anybody go out there and we didn't prepare properly. So having said that, we've spent $750 million on it for human space mitigation, and we have prevented nothing.
Whoa, wait a minute. So I constantly hear from callers and emailers, and every once in a while a guest, that we've absolutely mitigated and controlled radiation. That was proved on the studies going to Mars as to what the radiation level was, and we can use regolith, and we can use this, that, and the other. Not really a big problem unless we're going to spend lots and lots of times on the surface, which they are not advocating. And we have exercise routines, and then we could just spin a spacecraft for AG, and we'd be okay with the microgravity issue. So are you countering that kind of verbiage that I constantly hear on the show?
Well, we've spent an awful lot of money, and we have some pretty good guesses. But as far as mitigating actual problems that the people experience, no, we really haven't prevented anything. Right now, we've been through 7,275 missions in 58 years, 565 crews.
Hold on a minute. 7,275?
Missions.
Okay.
565 crews, 145 personal years in the last 58 years, and the majority of those were not focused on human factors, but were rather mission-driven. And if you go back and look, we have 300 hours on the moon which is approximately 2.08 days. We have 13.5 hours of an EVA, and we have 1% deep space information, and all the rest is LEO.
Okay. So that's not a whole lot of exposure to get information for.
Exactly. And that doesn't mean that, you know, things are horrible. It just means that previous missions were focused on whatever the mission was. You know, we're going to launch a satellite. We're going to, you know, get some dust from something. We're going to draw some blood here or there. We've got a few research animals. We're going to grow some plants. But not really focused on taking care of the human crew as the center of the mission, with the exception of Space Lab and I think the twin study and a few other ones. But generally speaking, almost everything was mission driven, not human factors driven.
So but we're talking about sending people to Mars, for example, and they talk about going to the moon. I personally have my doubts about that, but that's another story. Are we able to? Obviously, we can do this. So what's going to happen vis-a-vis human factors?
Well, let's back up a little bit. First thing, transition from being on Earth to celestial is a choice. You know, the people have to make that choice. And then you have to look at it in a historical context. And for this, I'm going to credit Dr. Jim Logan, who presented some of this data at the meeting I was just at. He reminded us that Magellan, when he came to the New World, lost 80% of his crew. You know, so you have to kind of put things in context. You also remember Apollo 13 was a rescue. The mission was aborted. It was a rescue, and we learned a lot. And it was a wonderful thing as far as saving the people and all that, but it basically ended up being a rescue. And when you fix one problem, sometimes that can cause another problem, and then you have a cascade of events that were not foreseen or prepared for. So there's a lot of misinformation out there. I think we're woefully unprepared for deep space. I think we need to go. We need to study. We need to do things. I'm not opposed to going or trying to prevent us from going. But I think we need a lot more information. Sometimes things sound good, and they're great on PowerPoint, but they're not reality. For example, space is always trying to kill you in one way or another. I think Gene Kranz was pretty famous, and Jim quoted him too, saying, "In God we trust, all others bring numbers." But when you talk about numbers, then we have a disconnect between the healthcare people and the engineers. So for a moment, I want to digress into just the different universes we live in. Engineers live in a mathematical universe where usually there's one correct answer, a lot of math, a lot of hard work, but one correct answer. Where healthcare people, we live in chaos theory and probabilities and, you know, other stuff. And we can tell you a lot about a group. Our gas laws are actually pretty close. We can tell you a lot about a group, very little about a particular individual. So we live in different worlds when we're trying to describe things. So, you know, there's a culture clash between the engineers and life sciences. We don't always understand each other. And at NASA, life science keeps being lowered down, and engineering is actually the group that runs or controls most of what goes on at NASA. So we have to kind of think about, what do we want to do? Is it a sortie where we just go up for a few days and come back? Or is it an outpost? Or is it a settlement we're trying to do, or is it a multiple generation frontier with generations and culture? We have to kind of decide what we want to do, because that's going to change the things we look at. Right now, the big showstoppers are radiation, hypogravity, and regolith. Those are the big showstoppers right now.
Why is regolith the showstopper?
Because the dust, it can be inhaled.
Oh, okay, I see what you mean.
A lot of it is crystal, which does damage to the lung tissue. A lot of it is volcanic gas. It's very biologically active. It has nanophase iron in it, which absorbs into the bloodstream and can cause some toxicity, and there's a lot of volatiles there. We don't really know exactly how people will react. Some of the flight surgeons were talking about a similarity to stone grinders disease, where they have problems breathing. We need to know what the toxicity of the dust is, and it's different between Mars and the moon. The people on the moon could not go and do more EVA because their visors were so scored by the dust, and they kept trying to wipe it off, but it was scratching, so that they really couldn't see through the visors anymore. So, you know, there's a lot of things that become at first seem minor, but, you know, if you can't see through the visor, all bets are off. So, you know, there's a lot of stuff. And several of the flight docs were talking about this soil toxic stew being a cancer causer, which then makes the radiation exposure and then the soil exposure, you know, a double whammy for the people.
I've got two emails and a phone call waiting, so I'm going to give you over to the caller first, okay?
Okay.
Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you? Where are you? Thank you for calling.
This is Marshall in Renfro, Oklahoma, and I love the opening. One of my first questions that popped into my head was, how much time has there been spent testing artificial gravity?
Oh, not much.
I was thinking Gemini program, if my memory serves me correct. They had a tether that they spun around for a couple hours or something, and that was about it?
Yeah, there's been several proposals. I believe that we should spin the cabin. And it has to be large enough that you mitigate the Coleus effect if you're too close to the center. But if you spin the cabin and you create the artificial gravity, that's going to help immensely, maybe solve the problem. But unfortunately, it's very expensive to build that. And that's why right now that hasn't been done, because NASA is constantly pressured, you know, save money, save money, save money. And if you're only going up for a short period of time, they figure the guys and gals can handle, you know, the changes and come back. But if we're going to go there and live, that's a different animal, and then we need to spin the cabin. Gravity is the answer.
The International Space Station, one of the reasons that they said we should build it was to test artificial gravity, and then they didn't, which means you have a bureaucracy perpetuation system, which means by putting off the main project, the whole project lasts forever.
Well, and here's where I'm going to advocate for my engineers and for my flight guys. Part of the problem is if you have to keep going back and redoing the budget in short periods of time, you can't really plan a multi-year project, because every time you go back, they change the budget. Well, will you change the budget? A lot of times lately, it's been down, and so then you have to go back on, well, what can we cut? What can we cut in order to stay solvent and continue working? And so they have a tremendous pressure that way. So I give them that. I understand why a lot of things happened, but we need to rethink how we fund these things. Because if you have a project that where you know you have guaranteed funding for, let's say, I'll be optimistic and say 5 years, instead of, you know, coming back so early, then you can plan accordingly, and you don't have to keep cutting things.
Yeah, it would be nice if we could get Congress out of the picture, too.
Well, and here's the competing people's ideas. Like I said at the beginning, I am not negative space. I am very pro-space, just a realist. There are people that think we shouldn't bother with it at all. So you're dealing with some of those. And so, again, you know, if you keep having to come to a budget problem every, you know, 18 months to every year, you know, it makes it very difficult to do things on a multi-year project. That becomes difficult. And in space, this is something we have to decide, and it's going to take many, many years. And here, the Chinese culturally think different. America thinks in short term. Chinese think in long term.
Yeah, I would just like to see more experimentation, because there's a lot of question marks when it comes to is there a difference between real gravity, artificial gravity, you know, how can we do things, et cetera, partial gravity. It's a whole big open hole that nobody's really touched.
Well, nobody knows, and that's the problem. I do not.
Yeah.
I cannot tell you whether one-third is enough or one-sixth is enough. I cannot tell you whether a fetus, which is growing in a pregnant woman, needs a requirement for gravity. My personal thought is it probably does, because it turns at different points, and there's different times during a development where things happen and they seem to be oriented in a particular way. So I'm guessing that it's an important thing, and I do not know what zero gravity would do. Nobody does.
Yeah.
You know, so no one's been born in space, and to my knowledge, nobody's been pregnant in space.
I won't touch that one at all. Anyway, enjoy talking to you.
Thank you, Marshall.
Bye.
Thank you.
Bye. Listeners, that line is open. I'm going to go to some of our emails real quickly, but if you want to pick up where Marshall left off, you can call at 866-687-7223. Have patience. I'll bring you up on air as quickly as possible. The initial email came from a young lady, Katie, and she says, I'm currently a nursing student and would love to one day work at NASA. The dream would be to provide health care to astronauts and be involved in research on the effects of spaceflight. Do you have any suggestions for career choices that might lead to that? One immediately thinks of ER trauma flight nurse, but if astronaut health care is less emergency and more assessment-based, perhaps something else would be more suitable. And how do nurses actually get jobs at NASA? Are they ever posted publicly? Thank you very much.
Okay, so first of all, no nurse has flown. The docs tend to do that themselves.
Yeah, of course.
Okay, so no nurse has flown. So I'm hoping that will change in the future as we have more people there, and we, you know, doctors will need nurses to assist them at some point in this project. However, right now, most nurses that work for NASA are trained through occupational health, and if you want to actually fly, then you have to have a second degree in a hard science. NASA does not recognize nursing as a hard science. And this, again, goes back to what I talked about originally, where we live in two different worlds. Engineers believe in hard science, so physics, chemistry, you know, numbers with one answer. And healthcare people live in chaos theory and gas laws and probabilities. And so they're in two different universes, and because nursing does not have that math background, it tends not to be as valued. It's still valued, but not as valued as we think. Even the doctors, the flight docs, suffer from this bias, and they talk about it among themselves. So if you want to fly, in order to be an astronaut, you must have a second degree in a hard science on top of being a nurse, which makes an added burden for you. But if you want to do that, you certainly can. I would start with occupational health. Most nurses are hired onto one of the various NASA installations, and they work in the health clinic taking care of the astronauts as well as their families and some of the NASA support crew.
Is it a good field to shoot for? Are the numbers, you know, for opportunities really tiny? Is it like a needle in a haystack for a nurse to go in that direction?
It's a very small group among nursing at this point in time, because the NASA installations are only, you know, a small group. And of them, only two or three actually work in healthcare areas. So Ames does all the animal studies. Johnson does a lot of human flight, but it is shared with Huntsville because of the way that developed over time. So those three NASA installations do have nurses that are working with astronauts, you know, through the health clinics. But, you know, some of the others, like, I'm not sure how involved Ames is. Ames might be, or not Ames, Langley, I'm sorry, might be doing other studies but not necessarily have astronauts on site. So right now it's only the three. So, yes, it is a very small group. In the Space Nursing Society, there's 450-plus of us, but most of us work either other jobs, civilians, flight nurses, like she was saying, ER and rescue, North Sea, offshore, oil platform kind of thing, which is kind of an analog in its own way because you have an isolated community, difficult to get to, that also, you know, has maybe nurses working with that crew there. So Antarctica, same thing.
You mentioned Ames does all of the, I heard you correctly, animal work. Is that
they do most of the, not all, but they do most of the animal work. Came originally from Ames.
So I'm curious, are there opportunities for veterinarians with NASA?
Yes.
Are there more veterinarian opportunities than, say, nursing opportunities?
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
Is Ames the only veterinarian center, or does NASA have them elsewhere, too?
No, you can apply to NASA through their, you know, remember, there's the three centers, and
uh-huh.
depending on what your study is and what you're looking at, they will decide. It depends on what you're doing. You know, like there was a lot of muscle studies done with mice and rodents. They were all animal studies. You know, they did hind limb suspension and all kinds of other things. A lot of those people were veterinary. Some were medical doctors.
Interesting. Okay, I got a couple of other emails in there from the same person, Doug, but he sent in two emails. So email number one. With the new exercise equipment on the space station, haven't we significantly reduced the bone mineral density loss and muscle mass loss?
No. We still lose 1% of bone per month. They have not been able to stop that. Muscles are a different animal. We've mitigated part of that. If they do the exercise, they maintain some of their muscle strength. They still atrophy to a degree, but it's not as severe. But as far as bone loss, no one's been able to stop that yet.
Does the exercise mitigate the bone loss?
No, not that I know of.
Okay, his second question is, let me pull it up. I'm hearing you bringing up a lot of problems, but you're not mentioning as many commonly mentioned potential solutions for, actually, I told you about this coming up before the show started, remember?
Mm-hmm.
For example, you mentioned the problem of abrasive dust, but you didn't mention any potential solutions. Aren't there several approaches that would be able to reduce the exposure to dust?
Well, okay. The problem is, and I, again, remember, I'm not against going. I'm very much pro going, but part of the problem is we have very limited time with the dust, and so, you know, drawing a whole lot of conclusions becomes difficult. I said here on Earth, when you have a construction site which is very dusty, they go out and water down the dust to keep it down on the ground. Not practical for the Moon or Mars. You do have to go out to do certain EVAs, and whenever you go out, you're going to be exposed to the dust as you're walking through it. It gets into the seams. It gets into the connections. It, you know, rains down on you on your visor. We had Curiosity was out for 253 days in space, and it had a problem because so much dust got onto the solar panels. Then we got a fortunate incident where there was a wind event or a dust event, as crazy as that sounds, where the wind blew a little bit and it blew some of the dust off the panels, and then we were able to power back up. So, you know, I wish I could say more. It's not that I don't want to say more. I'm not quite sure what we can do just yet for that.
I wish Doug would call, but I guess he's more comfortable today doing email.
Mm-hmm.
So he's still taking you to task, Linda. Some of the potential mitigation approaches for dust that have been mentioned on the space show include back entry suits, smooth surface suits, crew remaining in a rover while utilizing robotic manipulators to collect samples, magnetic combs to remove nanophase iron-covered dust, disposable coveralls, and telerobotic surrogates. And Doug, before Linda's going to answer, and she will answer, she's talking, you know, all of you do this, and it's really frustrating to me because, you know, I kind of keep telling everybody I'm a due diligence petty jerk here, and so I'm going to nail you again, and I know everyone's going to disagree with me, but what the hell? Look, she's talking about what we know in the here and now, not what may be potentially plausible that has not been tested, developed, built, funded, and tried. So if you look at where we are today, which was what my original question was, how have we advanced in 15 years? Okay, from when Linda was on the show before. Then she expanded that to the conference she was at for 58 years. It's where are we today with these challenges and these problems? If you said, Linda, give me a laundry list of everything possible and plausible over a 5-year to 20-year timeline to make changes in radiation, dust, cognitive abilities, this, that, whatever, you could have a list of 500 items. How many become real? How many are cost-effective? How many work? We don't know because they're plausible, but they're not in the here and now yet. So you're listing things, Doug, that are on the research board that may be very, very plausible, may work, and may be cost-effective, but you're twisting the here and now and where we are since she was last on the show and over that 58-year period from the conference to all of this stuff that's on the research board for the future. And that's apples and oranges, okay? So if you want to change the discussion with Linda and ask her, what's out there on the horizon that can make some difference, then great, I'm all for that. Maybe I'll ask her that question in a few minutes. But let's not mix apples and oranges. I guess that's what I'm trying to say. Now, Linda, I've interjected enough of my rant. you can respond to Doug.
Well, you're right. I mean, I would love to know if a vacuum system, when they came in, that would suck off all the dust as they came in would be helpful. I'm sure it would be. We don't have one. It's not been tested.
But it's on the plausible board.
But it's on the plausible board. And, you know, and the original question I was asked is, you know, what's going on now? Well, right now, dust is a problem. I'm open. Like I said, I'm not against going. I'm very pro-going. I'm open to whatever we think we can try, but none of that's been tried yet. So, you know, it becomes a tricky deal. They talk about the dust and radiation. Okay, for the moon for you to be shielded through regolith on the moon, you have to be down 13.8 feet. For Mars, approximately 8.7 feet. But then that means that you're going to live underground. Well, if you're going to live underground, then there's a whole different thing that goes on with people who live underground. We're still kind of strangers to darkness. Constant. It causes all kinds of problems, you know. So, you know, they have some cave studies that we've gone through, and we find out that some people hallucinate when they're, you know, in isolation like that for a long period of time. So, you know, and so there's a lot of stuff that still needs to be worked on, still needs to be done. There's a lot of money that needs to be put into this so we can study these things and find out what really works. But the dust is going to be a problem. If there's volatiles in the soil and they grow plants, will those transmit to the plants and then to the people when they eat the plants? I mean, I don't know. Nobody knows yet. We're still trying to see.
When you were at the conference that you referenced a little while ago, mm-hmm. Do they talk about futuristic, plausible, possible solutions, or were they past and the here and now only?
They were mostly talking about the here and now because there was you know, here we're back to our two different universes. The engineers, and I love them dearly, tend to think they can engineer around anything. Give them the parameters, give them the math, and they'll figure it out. And don't worry about it. It'll all be okay. But human beings are not necessarily, they don't always follow what you think they're going to do. And so, you know, they were kind of talking that through, the two groups were sort of talking that through and trying to figure out, you know, what, how can we meet in the middle and get things done? We want you guys to engineer solutions for us. That's a wonderful thing. But we need more studies to figure out what do we need, because we don't even know in some cases what we need.
Todd is in San Diego with a question, and he said everybody always wants to have more studies. More studies mean a lot more money, and they mean more time. So rather than have all sorts of studies that are some sort of analog studies here on Earth, mm-hmm. wouldn't it be better to just go and learn with on-the-job training?
Well, that's sort of the NASA philosophy at the moment. So when you're an astronaut, you sign a waiver that says you understand that flying could up to and including death. If you're willing to do that and you're in, you know, fit shape and you pass all the astronaut tests, then you can go.
I think probably most people in my audience, probably me too, I would say if you're willing to go and the people taking you have been reasonable in their precautions and security and quality control. I'm not talking about reckless, who gives a damn if you want to go, go.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not talking about that. Then I believe people should have the choice to go.
And I do too.
You know, I'm totally...
But you do have to understand that when you sign the paper, that's up to and including dying in space and not returning, or coming home and finding out you have cancer or you have, you know, who knows with the dust. Or, and here's even another one, if you've been away from Earth long enough, you may not be able to return.
How long is long enough?
We don't know. But if you lose your mineralization of your bones enough, if you lose enough muscle function, if your body alters enough to adapt to whichever environment you are in, you may reach a point where coming home would be dangerous.
Well, we have a lot of space debris out there then.
Yeah.
You have another caller on the line. I don't know who it is. The caller ID is not showing me. So, hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Welcome. Who are you? Where are you? And give it to us, please.
Hi, David. It's Tony Cook calling from Pasadena.
Hi there. How are you doing?
Oh, pretty good. It actually got warm today, so I'm out in the sun talking. Anyway, I have actually two questions. Number one, and this is based on, I was going to give a talk on Ham the Chimpanzee, and I read a book on animal studies in space, and the end of it was kind of alarming, because apparently the last time a primate was sent into space was, I think, in the 1980s, and it was a joint U.S.-Soviet biosatellite mission. And a monkey that had been in space for about 2 weeks, the capsule landed in Siberia during a snowstorm. So the recovery team decided, instead of waiting to get to a lab, which was delayed because of the snow, that they would take a marrow sample at the landing site. So they anesthetized the monkey, and surprisingly, the monkey died right away. And apparently, they think it may have been a zero-G adaptation problem where the medicine doesn't behave the way it always does when they do it, the process on a, you know, normal gravity situation where the monkey hasn't been in zero-G for weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Which I guess the alarm was that, like, if a crew has an accident on the ground after a long space flight, we probably don't know how to treat them.
Correct.
Do you have anything to say about that?
I do. Here's most of the animal studies that were done in depth were done by Dr. Greenleaf. They were done at Ames, and they were done in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s. That is the bulk of the, like, the big bed rest studies where they put 10, 12 people down, 6-degree head down tilt. They were looking at, they were collecting everything because they didn't know what was important or what was not important. And these were analog studies. Then you have the animal studies that were at the beginning of the space program when they were trying to decide, you know, can human beings even go above the atmosphere? Nobody knew for sure. And so they did Abel and Baker with the two monkeys originally and a couple other animals. And the Russians flew a dog named Laka. And they flew all these different animals and, you know, they survived, yay. Of course, then became samples themselves later. So, you know, it's hard to get people to volunteer for something when we don't know the outcome. Now, there are always a few that are brave, but, you know, to volunteer for this kind of studies is rough. So the animal studies are limited. Now, here's the other problem, and I'm going to bring in the twin study. Everybody's very excited about the twin study. But when you work in medicine, when we do a drug study, you get thousands and thousands of subjects before you go to the FDA to say that you know anything. Okay? So now we have the twin study with an N of 2, and they're twins. So is it an N of 2 or is it an N of 1.5? I don't know, because they were so closely identical twins. So it's a wonderful study. It shows us some very amazing things about his genes, 70 or 97% returned to normal upon landing, but, you know, some didn't. And so there's some question, you know, it's like it's either 93 or 97. So, you know, some of the genes did not change. They stayed altered, so the two guys are now a little more different than they were originally. But can I, as a healthcare person, say that I know a whole lot? Not really, not with an N of 2. And with animal studies, on the particular one that's in my mind, which was when the original primate that went up, that primate became sliced and diced for various different studies, and so was counted multiple times. But in the end, it's an N of 1.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we need to learn more, and I'm not trying to slow things down by saying, you know, we need endless studies. I'm not an endless study person, but you know, we have to collect more data. You know, they do fly, but we don't always collect data when they're flying that we would like to, and people forget that the astronauts are human beings. They have the right to say no. If you are a flight surgeon trying to collect data, you must ask permission of the astronaut. The astronaut has the right to say, I'd rather not participate in that particular study. So, you know, there's some complications. And then, of course, everybody wants the data, but we have HIPAA laws. So I can't tell you, you know, this astronaut at this time had this event because of HIPAA. You know, we have to be very, very, very careful about what we're saying. Otherwise, some of them will not want to participate because if anything negative happens, is that going to stop their career? You know, so
do you know if what I understood from that book is correct in that there's a doubt that we know how to do trauma medicine, like if a crew, you know, what I'm afraid, let me just back up a bit. My attitude is very much like yours, I think, as far as space travel. I would sincerely love that we would be living on Mars by now, stuff like that. However, I also believe what you said at the beginning of the show about not, you know, magic thinking. And what I'm afraid of is that with people living on the space station for months at a time, that we're lucky that we haven't had a show-stopping accident where, like, a crew, say, is injured, you know, to some extent on a landing, say, with something that requires surgery.
And then they wouldn't react.
And then we discover that how we do surgery on Earth doesn't work anymore because their bodies are not conditioned correctly.
Well,
and I have a feeling we don't have any data on that. Am I correct?
You're correct in that there's not a lot of data. the medications that go up to space have been limited. For ISS in particular, you know, you go up for 7 to 10 days and you're back, maybe 14 at the max. So it's like a camping trip, and we only take certain things up there. So we know that some of those medications do not work the way we expected them to.
Mm-hmm.
There has not been a whole lot of data as far as radiation exposure for the medication and humidity and temperature control and shielding from radiation. So years ago, in like 1994, I proposed along with a colleague of mine, Dr. O'Rangers, that we would put a dosimeter in the pack with the medication, just strictly to see what is the radiation exposure to the pack sitting there. That's all.
Mm-hmm.
Not even a particular medication, just what is the exposure? And, you know, because of budget constraints, because of a lot of reasons, you know, that wasn't a priority. The mission was the priority, and it didn't get done. So there are a few medication studies, but not many.
How much could it cost to put a dosimeter in a medication pack? Come on.
Well, it's complicated. In order to get the permission, first you have to know that pack is completely schematicked out, and every single tablet is drawn to where its position is. You know, I mean, it's very complicated. You add something to the pack, then the person who does that process has to redo the whole thing. Then you have to have the okay from all of the flight docs and all of the NASA people. And something as simple as, can we just throw a dosimeter in there, becomes a very expensive project. And then, you know, is the dosimeter flight certified, and has it been checked? And, you know, I mean, it the bureaucracy gets in the way. It really does.
Mm. Maybe that's something where commercial providers can help, because they might be able to do some of those experiments without quite as much red tape, do you think?
Well, I would like to. I would like to, because at the time, people got angry with me because they said, you know, they asked me, well, if we don't do this, what's the worst thing that could happen? Well, the obvious answer is someone could die. And I said that. And that did not go over well.
I have one other question, and that has to do with adaptation to daylight periods in different worlds that we might walk on or stay on. And I've asked people when they were, like, in Devon Island, you know, by email. I asked them, are you living on a 24-hour day or a Sol, you know, 4 hours and 40 minutes, roughly. And they go, oh, no, 24-hour day. And to me, like, if you're living on a Mars simulation, you'd probably want to simulate the length of the day. And I feel that way because whenever we go, like, on daylight saving time or standard time, I feel really about a week of not behaving right, you know, I mean, not being able to function up to speed completely. At least I'm aware that I'm a little bit more tired or whatever than usual. I feel jet lagged for a while, in other words. And I wonder how that would be actually with somebody moving to Mars, and really the day is a different length. And also, you get out of sync with the Earth by 40 minutes a day. And I know that didn't work well with the crew up the street here at JPL, because they tried doing that for the Mars exploration rovers, and you know, they stayed on the Sol day, and their lives kind of fell apart after a few months, so they stopped doing that. Also, the moon, of course, has like a 2 week day and night, or day, 2 weeks of day, 2 weeks of night. And your thoughts?
Well, of the planets right now, and what limited information we do have, Mars would probably be the easiest to adapt to, only because the day is very similar. It's almost a 24-hour day, not quite, but almost. So very, very similar. The problem is the seasons are much longer. So, you know, you're in a much larger orbit out there, so as you go from spring to winter to fall, you know, all that, that's much longer. But the day itself, not as different. Moon is going to be a real problem, because when you have people in constant sunlight, and then constant darkness, there's problems. And, mm-hmm. you know, my family happens to be Swedish, Scandinavian, and so, you know, when you start talking about 6 months of, you know, sunlight, 6 months of darkness, you go up to a place like Nordicap or Iceland, and you see how the people have to adapt in order to not end up with SAD, seasonal affective disorder.
Okay. Okay. So I would think that would apply, for instance, to Mars, too, because seasonal variations are probably no worse than Earth. That way, the tilt of the planets are very similar, so that would depend on what latitude you're at.
Right. The biggest problem with Mars is because of the radiation requirement, you're going to be underground.
Yeah. Do we have any information, though, on, like, say, Inuit people before they became, you know, westernized? Did they live on a 24-hour cycle, or did it just depend on the season and they slept a long time in the winter?
They didn't sleep a long time, but their activities were definitely modified, you know, winter to summer. It was mm-hmm. a different way of living, and it's the same in the high Arctic. It's the same in the Scandinavian countries when you get up to Svalbard and places that are high, and the same in Iceland. You know, you adapt. You have to get up and work at night because you still have to take care of animals. You still have to take care of things. And so you're working in the dark, and there was a lot of seasonal affective disorder. Now, with Mars, like I say, it's not so much the day hours, but the fact that in the beginning we're going to be either in a lava tube or we're going to be underground just from radiation protection, and you're dealing with ambient lighting that's artificial.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people, when they come back from the trips that they're on, you know, the ISS, when they're there for 4 or 5 months or longer, they miss simple things like the breeze on their face, like the smell of coffee,
right.
Like I pet my dog, being able to walk in the grass. One guy, the minute he got off, the thing he wanted to do was go swimming. So, you know, you don't realize what you miss until you don't have it. And then another group complained of background noise. Machine noise. It's incessant. It never ends, and it can't, because you have to keep your cabin healthy to make sure your crew is healthy. If your cabin is not healthy, your crew is going to be sick. So I call it sick cabin syndrome. You know, my background in nursing, I have 40 years in nephrology where people are attached to equipment. So I'm used to people having to live with equipment. And if your equipment is not okay, the people are not okay. You know, so that also is a big deal, because there's always breakdown, there's always problems. Your area over there at JPL, I mean, how many times does a Xerox machine not work, or you've got a problem with your phone line, or you know,
right.
something's
just
going on.
Just to be clear, I don't work for JPL, but it is close to where I live. I work at Griffith Observatory, I'm in contact with JPL people a lot.
Then up at Griffith Observatory, when the tower goes down and you have no power and you have to go out and start the thing up out there in the shed out there, you know, I mean, your equipment becomes very, very important. And if you have to maintain it, or you're going to lose the people. But the sound, it's a constant. You don't realize it till you come home to Earth and the machine noise is gone.
Yeah.
Tony, did you hear, because I know you listen to a lot of shows, did you hear the show I did with Alice Glenn, who is from Barrows, Alaska, and an Inuit a native, and she talked about the extreme of space and the extreme of the Barrows, Alaska environment and the dark.
Oh, no, I don't think I've heard that show.
So
how long ago?
March 4th, 2018, and how they survive it and what they do, because they go to school and it's pitch black out. They play. They go outside. How have they adapted to do all of this? And NASA studies them, and Barrows, Alaska is a study point. And she's actually worked for NASA and went and got a space engineering degree at one of the Florida universities. I forget which one. And I met her at a space conference, a young lady, and I may get her back on the show. But it is really an illuminating thing, because the way they deal with it, in Barrow is it's a cultural thing for their entire community. And they're all kind of in the soup together. So you ought to listen to it. It's
I'll go back and listen to that, yeah.
It's teamwork, it's sharing, it's you know, how they culturally hang together. They meet, they do things as a community, and they have events as a community, and there's an enormous amount of reinforcement and one-on-one support and a lot of custom and tradition that they value. They actually value it. Even the younger members value it, and they have elders that they look up to that teach the youngers. It's not just something you do like you're living in Los Angeles.
No.
Maybe you'd benefit in San Francisco and Los Angeles. I'm not saying we wouldn't. But it is a very different kind of life than what we have down here.
Wow.
So,
well, thank
again,
you very much. Fascinating
yeah,
show.
March 4th, 2018.
I'll listen to that.
The Harold Project,
yep.
Also, they put people into a habitat smaller than an average apartment, no windows, no contact with the outside world. And mm-hmm. it was for 45 days, and it was quite a shock for the people as they went through it. They were surprised at what they missed. They got into a routine, just as David is describing, where interesting things became very important. Birthdays, getting dressed for dinner was a big deal. Making sure that that nobody was being annoying. You know, you had to, you know, really be careful that you didn't aggravate people. It was something.
Did their circadian rhythm change?
Yes, they had circadian rhythm changes. They looked at their stress hormones, their nutrition. They had their blood counts done. But they said that when they all came out, they missed their pets. Pizza, milkshakes, mm-hmm. their gardens, being able to run, go outside, and stand in the sun with the sun on their face.
Yeah.
What this is called? Halo, H-A-L-O.
Hera.
Okay.
It's H-E-R-A, and it was their 17th, I think. It looks like a V15 deal.
Okay.
On it.
Okay.
Yeah, so they did that, and again, you know, it's basically small groups in isolation. But mm-hmm. then birthdays and all that kind of stuff became important. That happened at Biosphere 2, which I was working with at the time. Biosphere 2, they birthdays, special events became extremely important, and they even at one point were trying to figure out how to ferment some of the fruit. So that kind of gives, and they were in for, like,
2 years. Well,
yeah,
it was supposed
years.
To be a long time. Yeah,
it was a long time.
Yeah. It's just, I think that people simulating missions, it would be good. Like, even if it's just their ambient light that's changing on the cycle of wherever they plan to land versus their Earth communication, which is going to be on a 24-hour cycle, I would think that would be an element of realism on an extended test that would be valuable to know what happens. I mean, do you prefer a soul, or do you prefer a 24-hour day?
No, you got to put in the delay, and that's what we did on a Mars simulation. The delay is 20 minutes.
The people you're talking to are on a totally different cycle than the planet you're on.
Right.
If you live by, again, you're saying that the ambient light sort of may not be a factor because they'll be living underground.
No, saying it is a great factor.
Well, I mean, it's that kind of factor, but living in the daylight probably isn't practical on either the moon, or safe, or possible maybe on the moon or Mars for extended periods.
Well, not until we terraform or do something about radiation. But in addition to that, you know, the communication becomes a big deal. Because, like, you ask a question. If you were asking me that on Mars, I would have to wait 20 minutes to get the question. Then I have to mm-hmm. think about my answer. Then I have to send you back the answer and wait 20 minutes to see that you got it, and then wait another 20 minutes to see what your answer after I gave my answer. Well, that is okay if we're having this kind of conversation. But if you're in a crisis and someone's in trouble and you're sending, like, an emergency you know, what do we do about this? You know, this delay going back and forth is not helpful.
Right. Now, it was enough even during the moon missions, you would hear communicators stepping on top of each other. I mean, the astronauts sometimes would be speaking the same time as the ground just because of the delay.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you very much. I'll let someone else call in.
Thank you for your call, Tony. Appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Listeners, Tony has cleared that line, and it is 1-866-687-7223. I suspect I'll skip the break, but I do want to thank second segment sponsors. So let me do that real quickly. The Space Development Network is a sponsor. Would you like to see space settlement occur within your lifetime? The Space Development Network is an online organization that allows you, the space advocate, to join together with others to advance a plan for space development. They're looking for people with a wide variety of interest and skill. It is a free network to join, and you can check it all out and learn more at spacedevelopment.org. The National Space Society sponsors us, NSF. They have ISDC coming up. It's in Alexandria, Virginia. I think it's June 6th through 9th. It really has a stellar group of speakers and programming planned. Greg Autry is the head of the conference this year. He's going to be on the show in a couple of weeks again. He's was an advisor on space business to the early days of the Trump campaign, and then he is now a business school professor and an outspoken space commercial space advocate at the University of Southern California. But anyway, NSS is a great organization. We thank them for their sponsorship. ISDC is going to be really powerhouse packed. I'm hoping I can get there for it. Check them out at their website, nss.org, and then you'll see ISDC up at the top, and you can click on it. And again, it's in Alexandria, Virginia, which is the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area. Celestis is a sponsor, and they are still the only really successful Memorial spaceflight provider in the world, I think. And you can launch cremated ashes, about 1 to 2 grams worth, of your loved one to space, either from the Cape, suborbitally from New Mexico, or from Vandenberg. They're going to the moon soon, and hopefully also in the not-too-distant future they'll be able to go to Mars and maybe deep space in general. And if you want to symbolically go with your loved one, you can add a little bit of your DNA to the capsule as well and make that journey with them. It's a great way for closure. I am their customer, and they're a great company to do business with. I would suggest if you're interested, and it really is a great program, check them out at celestis.com. And then the Integrated Space Plan is our sponsor, and this is the highly developed and detailed flowchart showing the path to becoming a spacefaring race. You can see how technologies and destinations build upon one another, explore hundreds of individual elements in more detail at their website, thespaceplan, all one word, .com. And you can buy a copy of it full size. It's in two different sizes and varieties. They explain that on their website. So everybody check it out, thespaceplan.com. And we are in the second segment. Linda Plush is talking with us today about what's been happening. Are we learning anything? Where are we headed with human spaceflight medicine? So that was a pretty active first segment, Linda.
That's a good thing. To go back to radiation for a moment, since
okay.
It is one of the big items.
Go ahead.
Right now, when you're at sea level, the radiation protection would be equal to about 100. When you're at 18,000 feet in a plane, it drops to 50. When you're on ISS, it's 2. When you're on a lunar lander, it's 0.5. And when you're in a spacesuit, it's 1/10 of 1% of Earth. So moving that to Curiosity for a moment, Curiosity was 253 days in space and received 200 times the average Earth radiation, the equivalent to a CT scan for the next 8 months every 5 to 6 days. So, again, you know, radiation is one of the big things that we do have to come to some protection with. And then for people that aren't familiar with it, when we talk about radiation, galactic radiation becomes a big deal when you don't have atmosphere to protect you. And it's not a straight line coming in particle. It you can visualize it like a broom, where there's a line and then it fans out and does damage in the fanning out. And a way for people to kind of even look at it here on Earth, you can go to spaceweather.com and they will put up the hot flights of airplanes just traveling on commercial flights and which ones received, you know, a nice dose of radiation. So I just for fun, I clicked for yesterday, or actually February 23rd, and there were the five top flights that received the most radiation. They were chartered flights, and they were from Teterboro to Burbank, from West Palm Beach to Teterboro, and then into Van Nuys, and then one to Miami. Commercial flights, all of them were originating in Chicago, and the majority of them ending in the East Coast. So, you know, even just watching here on Earth, you have to kind of think about the radiation, and it's different. It's different for every location. It's different for ISS. It's different for the Moon. It's different for Mars. It's, you know, it's quite a complicated problem.
The planes don't do any shielding for this, do they?
Well, some radiation can be stopped with aluminum, you know, a small shield of aluminum. But the planes do not go out of their way to do anything unusual about radiation. It's not like ISS where we have a place where they can go in, you know, the shielded area in case we have a gamma ray burst. The reason I was kind of bringing it up was we had a solar flare that just missed us in the last, say, today. It just missed us. I usually watch this stuff, so they said it would probably not disturb our stuff on the planet today, and it's because we're in a solar minimum where the solar wind is not distracted with sunspots, and so you can go there and it'll actually show the flare coming off of the sun, and we just got lucky and dodged it this time. But, you know, even here on Earth, we have problems with galactic radiation, with solar radiation, with solar wind, with all kinds of things. And we have somewhat of a heavy atmosphere for protection, but you go to other locations and it's not the case. We've been very lucky that a lot of our flights and time up there have been at a point where the sun was not very active. We've gotten very lucky. We've sort of dodged that bullet so far.
Why do you think that we don't have more solutions, real-time solutions, and we don't have artificial gravity and stuff? It's got to be something other than just the cost, or is the cost truly why, or is it that some people say, you know, that NASA and a lot of the policy people just really don't care that much about human spaceflight, especially with robotics now coming in?
Well, it depends on the goal. If the goal is to look at the solar system, you can do it much better with robotics. And then I would championship my JPL guys and say, yes, they're absolutely correct. You can go lighter, smaller, faster, with more instruments on board if all you want to do is collect data and you want to explore, you know, our solar system and beyond, then robots the way to go. But if your goal is to go off-world and actually colonize and have settlements, that's a whole different thing. And now, you know, now healthcare becomes the tall, you know, or at least a I wouldn't say the tall one in the tent, but at least a co-actor, you know, you have to have healthy people in order to have a settlement. So, you know, it depends on what the goal is. And like I said, we've been very lucky that we have not had, as Jim Logan would say, a black swan event. We've been very lucky that we've not had, you know, some horrible radiation, you know, flash from the sun or from, you know, something from outer space or, you know, we've been lucky. We've been very lucky. So.
Why do we not have missions that have human spaceflight type of goals? Why are the goals always something else? I mean, I understand the access is hard and costly. Is that the reason? But, I mean, it would seem to me that the humans can do more than the robotics in many ways, but the opportunities to use them are not there, and we lag behind on transportation and, you know, costs are high and, you know, the whole thing. Is it just that space exploration is going to pass humans by?
I hope not. Like I said from the beginning, I'm an advocate that says, yes, we need to go. You know, I would not want us to be a one planet species. You know, if we really are thinking long term, we need to get out there. But you have to define the goal. What is the goal? If the goal is settlement on off world, then we have to readjust what we're doing. And we have to have more people and more specialties brought in. We have to have veterinary brought in. We have to have plant biologists brought in to find out, you know, here's a thought. You're looking at all the planets in the whole solar system. Why is Earth the only one with a tree? Have you ever seen a tree anywhere else?
Only because that they haven't set their instruments down where the trees grow.
There you go. but my point is, you know, you need all these specialists. You need all these different groups, not just a select few. We need everybody at the table. Everybody has special gifts to give to make it work right. We need the people that know how to do food that isn't going to spoil or be, you know, can be stored for time. We need the people that know how to grow plants that aren't going to be damaged by radiation and crazy soils. We need to have, you know, everybody there, the healthcare people, the engineers, everybody, you know, each specialty needs to be there. It's a very big dream to go to space, and it's complicated because you have to deal with water, you have to deal with soil, you have to deal with food, you have to deal with light, you have to deal with weather. I mean, weather people would need to be there as well. Satellite people, repair people. You've got all this equipment. You better have people that know how to fix it. So it shouldn't be a select group. We need everybody there. So it depends on our goal. Like I said, if we're just going to go and take pictures and do a few samples, then robotics is the way. But if people are going to go, then we have to change our approach and we have to bring more people to the table. I have always been amazed at how the different specialties do not talk to each other. Have you noticed this?
Yeah, of course they don't. Uh-huh.
The engineers don't talk to the chemists, who don't talk to the veterinary people, who don't talk to the plant biology people, who don't talk to the people who build shelters. You know, it's nice to say, well, okay, the engineer says it has to be this many inches thick. And then you talk to the guy who actually builds it, and he goes, I can't do that. You know, I have to have some better, you know, information in order to make that happen the way they want it to happen. You know, so you need engineers. You need everybody. And right now, unfortunately, a lot of them don't talk to each other.
Sally is in Seattle with an email for you. And she says, from what you're saying, I would say that probably for the foreseeable multiple decades, assuming we can get to Mars, at best we would just be getting there and spending some time there and coming back, or maybe having a very, very small outpost that turns around every once in a while, because the teams, the resources, the people that you're talking about don't exist as a team anywhere, not even in China. And it would be decades to amass that type of effort for space settlement. So I think early on, at best, they're round-trip missions or missions that spend a couple of years on Mars but then come back. Do you see it unfolding any other way?
Well, you know, if the world were perfect, we'd get ourselves together, but it's not. And so, you know, she's right in that the initial missions to Mars will be small. It's very expensive, and, you know, we have just getting there is an issue. It's either 6 months if you go when Mars is closest, or 2.5 years when Mars is farthest away, and then depending upon how long you have enough supplies, you know, you turn around, you know, you have to wait until the planets line up again to come home. So it's not a, you get halfway there and decide this is not going to work, I'm going to turn around and go home. You know, it doesn't work like that. And so the farther away we go from Earth, the more dangerous it becomes. But yes, I think the first ones will be small. But you know, the people that left on ships to go to the new world, you know, again, like I said at the beginning, they lost 80% of their crew. They loaded their ship with everything they thought they needed. They planned as best they could. They didn't know what they were going to find, and they went. And, you know, that's kind of the human spirit. You know, are we going to do something like that? It'll probably be something similar. You know, it'll be a foray of, you know, maybe, I don't know, 10, 5, however many brave souls. But the first group that goes, believe me, they're going to sign the paper that says up to and including death and may not return.
Yeah, I think they'll be fine with that. I don't think the release is where the problems will be. You have another caller. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you? Where are you, please?
This is John in Fort Worth. Earlier they were kind of getting into the artificial gravity issue, and of course that's what I was thinking about. Is I think that it would be very useful, but the downside is the whole issue of Coriolis effects, I think, and maybe something else, which might be just, I'll call it vibration, how stable you can really keep the thing that would affect humans. Do we have any idea on Coriolis and how much the human body will be affected by that?
There's been a couple studies. They have some centrifuges where the people are done sitting as well as lying down, and depending on the size of the centrifuge, you can work a little bit on the Coriolis effect. Closer the head is to the center, the more of the effect is bothersome. We would need to, in order to do gravity, though, you're right, it has to be a fairly decent circle, you know, quite a bit across. And so that becomes expensive, which is why in the past it's always, you know, when the mission has always come up, that they didn't want to put that much into that when they could do so many other things. So, again, you know, I'm back to what is our focus? What do we want to do? If it's only to go take pictures, you know, that's one thing. But if we're really going to go, we need to spin it. And, you know, it's expensive to do. So there's been some testing. I mean, you know, the famous one is with von Braun, put his design in place for what he thought would work. You know, that was back in the 50s and 60s with Collier's magazine. Some of the flight docs have alluded to 2001: A Space Odyssey, where some of the crafts rotated. Again, saying, you know, something similar to that would make more sense. But all of it is very expensive. And it depends on our goal.
Yeah. Well, I think that one other problem is, I believe, would be movement. I play around with the math a little bit. It looks like that when you move is when the thing really has the biggest effect, I think, when you're trying to walk or something.
Well, if it's spinning and you're walking on the outside edge, the internal edge anyway, but if you're walking, it's not as big a deal. But to do that, you're talking about a very large circle. You're not talking about a little bitty circle. So, you know, that's in order to make it work so that you don't have the big vibration and a lot of the problems you're describing, it has to be large. And large is expensive.
Yeah, that's true. Well, but I mean, it seems like if you're going to do a Mars mission, unless you have something that's very much faster than what we're normally thinking about with, say, a chemical rocket, you're basically, the condition people are going to be in by the time they get there may not be very useful for them doing their exploration mission when they try to land. I mean, it'd be like equivalent of 9 months in microgravity or something like that before they even get there.
Well, and nobody knows. Are they going to be okay when they stand up? We don't know.
Right.
So, and we're going to lose a percentage of muscle and bone, and how weak will they be? We really don't know. I mean, we know when they come back here after they've been up for a year. What we don't know is when they land on Mars, because Mars is a different location, a different set of values. You know, how are they going to be when they're there? Nobody knows.
Nobody has a clue on that one.
Nobody has a clue.
Yeah. Well, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Thank you, John. Appreciate it. Listeners, there is still a little bit of time left. If you would like to get a call in, you need to hurry. And the toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. And the email address is drspace@thespaceshow.com. Linda, what did you want to talk about, or what should we have talked about that we haven't done so yet?
Oh, my goodness. There's so much that's out there. It's hard to pick any one thing. Just a recent vision study, just since we're health-oriented, John Phillips, he had 20/20 vision when he went to space. When he was in space, his vision became 20/100, and then upon return, it returned to 20/50. And there's been talk recently about vision, and it seems to be vision changes seem to happen more in the men than it does the women. But again, I stress that our ends are small, and that may not actually play out in the long run. It may end up being equal. But right now it seems that there's some vision issues as well, and we're not clear on what's happening exactly.
Do we have any way to affect vision problems while you're in the ISS or while you're in space, or is it all just a new big unknown area?
Right now, it's kind of unknown. It depends on what your vision changes to, and then you would need glasses, right?
Right.
Okay, so who's going to make the glasses in space?
Well, I know they have adjustable diopter glasses.
Yes.
So I've never tried one on. I don't know how well they work, but
yes. Yes, but then, you know, they have to tweak them a little bit. And then, you know, 20/50 is not horrible. 20/100, you know, you have to kind of, but think about this in a crisis when the guy needs to read, you know, the manual or read the panel for something very important. You know, and if you've been up there long enough that your vision's affected, could you flip the wrong switch? Yeah, you could. So, you know, we don't really know. It's kind of a new thing that people are talking about now. We don't know what it is.
Well, 20/40 is what the DMV requires.
Mm-hmm.
I think you can correct that so that you can be 20/40 and wear glasses. And I know cataracts are an issue in space. So if you're losing your vision and you have cataracts, I know from personal experience that is an absolute unmitigated disaster.
Well, and they see flashes. The astronauts talk about seeing flashes, and when they see those flashes, that's cosmic radiation that's doing, you know, some damage there. And they will see those.
It does damage when you see the things?
Well, that tells them that they some radiation has passed by them. So they know. You know, because a lot of times you don't really know. I mean, radiation is generally not visible. But when they see this flash of light in their eye, they know.
How do you interpret the cognitive studies? So those have been controversial because Dr. Zubrin, for example, and others criticized the way they dosed the mice or the rodents in order to do the experiment, saying that it's so unrealistic for a human that it's not a good experiment. Of course, the doctors doing the experiments don't agree with that and explain why they dose the rodents with radiation the way they do. But it appears to affect cognitive behavior. What do you know anything about that? Are you following that?
Well, I'm watching, but with that, you look back at what happened to people that were exposed to radiation here on Earth, and you know what happened to them and how did they react. So with cosmic radiation, a lot of biological damage happens. We're still trying to figure it out. Like, for example, they'll get more exposure just living in Denver. You know, so altitude matters here. But a lot of people that were exposed during the Japanese experience during World War II, they're following quite a few of them to see, you know, is this going to be a problem? It's really, really hard to know just yet. A lot of people don't document all the things that they feel and see. And that's another issue.
Don is in Tucson, and he may be the last question of the day, but if somebody wants to get a call in, we will take your call. And let me throw it out there one more time on the phone, 866-687-7223. We love phone calls on the Space Show. Don says, in your opinion, since you've been talking about the very small sample size, what would be the sample size to where you would be comfortable having reliable information on many of these issues, solutions, mitigation ideas, or strategies?
Well, you know, the larger the better, but certainly hundreds compared to one or two would be much better. But again, you know, we are at the mercy of who's flying, who's willing to participate. They have the right to say no. And, you know, what the mission is at the time that allows us to collect what we can. So, you know, it's a real tough situation for healthcare because, you know, a crew on the shuttle was anywhere from, what, 7 to, you know, maybe a max of 14 or 12, and only for a week or two. And then when you get up to station, usually the crew is somewhere between 3, 5, and maybe temporarily higher if shuttle is docked. There's not the numbers of people that have flown yet that make me confident in saying that we know much of anything, really. I mean, total hours, I think we have 500-something that have actually flown, and many of those did not participate in healthcare stuff. They were busy launching satellites, repairing the Hubble, you know, doing other things. And so a lot of those events did not have healthcare information collected at that time.
But aren't they monitored for all sorts of healthcare facts and issues and changes in their body? So they're collecting an enormous amount of data from everyone?
They'll get your basic vitals for sure. They'll get some of them, not all of them, will have blood drawn. We do have urine and feces collection. That has been pretty stable. But everything else, you know, they have the right to say no. In fact, they have the right to say no to a blood collection if they don't want to participate. So, you know, it depends. And if you're up there and your big mission is to repair the Hubble telescope, you're not worried about a blood sample.
I wouldn't think so. So they don't say, if you want to fly, you participate. If you don't have to participate if you don't want to, but then we don't have to take you.
Well, kind of. I mean, there are certain things that you have to do to be an astronaut. You know, they go through basic healthcare screens and all kinds of things. But to participate in a specific study is different than having your flight doc take care of you. Those are two different things. So NASA may be collecting data that's part of that astronaut's medical record for NASA, but that they may or may not decide to also participate in a particular study on ISS or whatever they're flying. So, it's two different medical records.
Interesting. What else should we have talked about? Or if we had a six-hour show, what would be next on your list?
Well, the fun thing to do sometime would be a Mars or a lunar simulation. They're fun. Eleanor and I did those a few years ago, where you give the audience a problem and give certain groups, part of the information, and then they have to work it just like they were in NASA or in Mission Control or on the base and work through the problem. And that's always a fun thing to do because it brings home everything for everyone. So the engineers start to appreciate because they'll say, well, we're just going to give them this. Tell them to do this. And then the people who are working the other side of the problem say, well, in order to do that, we had to have this special wrench. Is that special wrench been flown? Is that on the ship in the first place? And then everybody's checking their list to see, well, is that equipment present and accounted for? Can they have it? And it was sort of brought home in Apollo 13 when they had to build a scrubber for the CO2, but they could only do with what they had aboard.
Is that simulation suitable for radio?
Yeah, it's been done on radio. It was done with the crew we did recently. I'll get the name and everything for you. But yeah, it's a fun thing to do because it helps the engineers think, like, we give them the medical problems and we give the medical people the engineering problems. We swap it up so people have to live in somebody else's shoes for a minute and try to figure it out.
That would be fun to do if it could logistically be done.
Yeah.
Anything you're looking forward to in terms of big, big changes or breakthroughs in 2019?
We are watching the civilian space suborbital flights with interest. There's a whole different gamut there about healthcare and what's appropriate to fly for that. And, people don't realize that the group of people that can afford that are usually a little bit older and have some healthcare issues. And so it's interesting to see how they're being screened and prepared for that flight. And interesting things would knock you out of that flight. For example, if you were having dental work done and you had your jaw wired, you would not be able to fly. But maybe if you had cancer, you would be able to fly. You know, so it's a whole different mindset for the civilian suborbital hop. And so we're watching this one with interest to see how this is all going to play out. I think Spaceship One just did one of their preliminary flights getting ready for civilian flights shortly.
Yeah, Spaceship Two.
Yeah.
They did. They did very well on it from everything that we've been reading. Well, that will be fun to follow, and we maybe can bring you back after we learn a little bit about what happened on some of their early flights and see if we're getting any of the information. If they release it, they're a private company. They don't have to release any of this information, do they?
No, they don't. And here's the other thing. You know, it's like civilian airplane flights. People fly all the time that maybe shouldn't. So, if you had a lung infection and pneumonia, you really shouldn't be flying on a plane, but
they don't do any screening for us.
Right. And so this is going to be very interesting to see because you're not talking about people that are screened through NASA, astronauts that are very physically fit. We're now talking about the public. And so it's going to be very interesting to see how this plays out over the next couple years.
Well, we will be checking in with you to see that. So, any other comments? Any other things you want to point us toward?
There's so much; it's like hard to know where to point first. But we have a Facebook page for space nursing. If anybody is interested, it's Space Nursing on Facebook. You just look us up, and we put the most interesting things that are coming up there.
Okay.
And then also, I'm just like I said, watching to see what's happening. NASA has been fairly quiet, the last couple of years. So there hasn't been a whole lot there, but we're watching China. We're watching India. We're watching also Japan. So it's interesting.
Well, we will look forward to checking back with you, and I want to thank you very much for being with us on today's program. And I will get it archived and up and send it to you, and look forward to talking to you again.
Thank you for having me.
Listeners, that is going to conclude us for today. So do look at the upcoming show schedule, and the website newsletter will be posted shortly. And we do have a program tomorrow, and then every day this week, and Hotel Mar should be back if Mr. Batchelor continues to feel well. And we're going to be talking about the final loss of opportunity, and that will be the Hotel Mar show, again, depending on John coming back and feeling back to normal. Everybody have a great rest of the weekend, and we thank Linda for being with us. Goodbye from Linda, David, and the Space Show.